Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the show today, the X-Men, Janet Yellen, and someone known as the Marijuana Mayor. Oh, I'd read that comic book. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From APM in Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 20th of March, and it's great to have you with us. Friday means it's time again for the weekly wrap for maybe 5 minutes of live radio. We'll see what happens. And it's a chance to look back at the week that was. And our Washington Bureau is Sadeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal. Hey, Sadeep.
Hi, David.
And Lee Gallagher is in New York. She's with Fortune Magazine. Hi, Lee.
Hi, David.
Sadeep, let's start with the Federal Reserve. It had another one of these regular meetings this week. We waited with bated breath for the statement that followed and the press conference on the heels of that. And there was a lot of hubbub over the word patience or the absence of the word patience. What did we learn this week from the Fed?
We learned that the Fed can be patient without using the word patience, and that's exactly what it's going to be doing for much of the rest of the year. The moment that statement came out, you could see the sigh of relief hitting trading floors across Wall Street, that the reckoning was being postponed for another day so that we don't have to deal with a world where interest rates aren't near zero. But the rest of us should be a little concerned still about how weak the economy looks to the Fed. This was not a vote of confidence from the Fed on the U.S. economy, and it doesn't look like we're going to see a big upturn anytime soon, even though we're now 6 years into the economic recovery.
Lee, let's talk a little bit about timing and why it is so important whether or not this happens in April. I guess it's not going to happen in April. Whether it happens in June or September, what difference could it make?
Well, the error here is that the Fed does this too soon when the economy isn't strong enough to stand on its own. And it seems like they would rather err on the other side. They'd rather wait too long. And that patience absolutely is still there. And I echo what Sudeep said. I mean, I think that there was so much agita over the word patient, but the much bigger surprise was all this data that came out. And they really lowered their expectations for growth for this year, even as, you know, we're having some pretty great jobs numbers, but they're just not. We're just not there yet, especially in terms of things like wages. So, you know, timing, I think it's going to be later rather than sooner.
Sadeep, we've done this many times now, you and I, and we often talk about the price of oil. It's in the news yet again as we continue to see these very, very low prices for barrels of oil. It's nearing $40. You know, how long do you expect that'll continue, and what's the significance of that, Ben?
It looks like it's going to continue for quite a bit longer. What we're seeing right now is, a surprising degree of resilience from oil producers. Everyone seems to want to tough it out. They want to hold on without making the production cuts, the layoffs that they probably will have to do eventually. And the longer they hold out, the longer it'll take for us to see the true correction in the oil market that allows things to get back to what will be a more sustainable course in the long run. And so this week just showed how much the market is looking for those signals and how few reliable signals there are coming from oil producers around the world.
I just want to close with a corporate story. I'll go to you firstly. You know, it hasn't been a great week for companies and their brands. I think most principally about Starbucks and this hashtag campaign that it started, this Race Together campaign. What do you make of how that company handled that, sort of what it expected to get out of that campaign?
Well, yeah, I think what it expected was very different than the reality. I think it really shows how powerful social media is today. It's sort of an instant adjudicator on what everyone thinks about this, and it's pretty accurate. I think that this was a really genuine attempt. Starbucks has tried to use its coffee cups, its scale for good before. Howard Schultz has got this sort of activist side to him, the CEO. But I think in this case, this is just such a fraught issue, and it really walked that line that was, a little too close to where people were comfortable. And also, I don't think anybody necessarily wants to go in and talk to their barista in the morning. I don't know. That, there's that practical side of it, too. But anyway, I think it will blow over.
I don't think I'm going to be doing that. And I agree with Lee. You never want to discourage a company from being a good corporate citizen and trying to do something more for its community. This one seemed like it needed a little bit more thought before it rolled out. Maybe there are other issues that are going to be less fraught and less emotional. Perhaps somebody could start with obesity and pick one of those before they get into it, but then you get into a whole lot of other corporate issues when it comes to nutrition that they probably don't want to touch.
Sudeep Reddy with The Wall Street Journal, Lee Gallagher with Fortune Magazine. It's always great to talk to both of you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Thanks.
On Wall Street Today, things ended the week on an up note. Details when we do the numbers. The internet is a utility, and all online traffic must be treated equally. That is a very simplified version of what the FCC decided a few weeks back. Cable companies lost the big battle. They will not be allowed to charge the Netflixes of the world more money for an internet fast lane, or so it seemed. Comcast has been in talks with HBO, Sony, and Showtime, The Wall Street Journal reports. They're hoping to get special treatment. Here's Stan Alcorn on what could be the next stage of the net neutrality debate.
Net neutrality is supposed to make things fair on the information superhighway that is the public internet. But the loophole is that is not the only highway the cable company is running into your house. In fact, the cable company is running three highways, one for public internet, one for television, and one called specialized services.
What's going on is that the FCC has left unregulated the pipe labeled specialized services.
Susan Crawford is a co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. She says cable companies could, in theory, push online video consumers off the public internet by capping their bandwidth and then steer them to products from HBO or Sony, which would pay to use a new fast lane on the specialized services highway.
I think the best way to think about it is that it moves the pay TV model successfully into something that consumers will view as an internet-like interface.
So Sony wants to aggregate a bunch of channels and deliver them directly to Sony PlayStations and charge consumers.
That's Ian Olgerson, analyst at SNL Kagan.
So that's essentially replacing a cable subscription.
In this scenario, he says the cable companies would get money from Sony and maybe even reduce congestion on the public internet, but he thinks it doesn't add up because of the way it would cut into the company's pay TV business.
There's sort of a trade-off for the operators. They're giving up a revenue stream to gain another revenue stream.
And Susan Crawford points out the FCC has reserved the right to regulate if it finds specialized services are being used as a net neutrality loophole. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Europe hadn't seen a solar eclipse this big for years. Many Europeans thought it was pretty cool, but a few others were worried. They are grid operators and utility workers in Germany and Italy. Solar power has grown to be a significant part of the electricity supply in those places. So what happens when the sun goes away at once? Well, that concern shines some light on a big challenge. As renewable energy grows, how do you integrate it into the grid? Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
Of course, it does get dark every single day, but not all at once. Sunset, dusk, you're talking an hour there, and that gives time to spin up other generators. Because the big challenge for grid operators is always balancing out supply and demand in real time. Anthony Paul is a fellow at the think tank Resources for the Future.
Fossil-fired generators are not like stereos. You can't just turn the volume from 5 to 10.
Generators take time to ramp up and down. What happens when the sun comes back and you've still got all that power from your other sources? Maybe an overload. People worried about blackouts. As it happened, they did fine. No blackouts. But it shows why, even with just regular stuff, night falling, clouds rolling in, solar means extra work for grid operators. And then there's what's called distributed generation, rooftop solar. The grid isn't really built for it. John Larson is a director at the Rhodium Group.
Traditionally, our grid has been a one-way street.
Power comes from the generator through the network to your house.
But now as you're getting more and more distributed generation out there, rooftop solar and the like, you're turning it into a two-way street.
And the street may not be wide enough to handle traffic in both directions. For instance, Germany. Ben York is a research engineer at the Electric Power Research Institute. He says there's now six times as much power coming up from some places on Germany's grid as you traditionally had going out to them.
You go back to that street analogy, if you had originally two lanes going one way, now you've got to add six or seven lanes going back the other way.
He says Germany is looking at a $30 billion investment to create those lanes in the next few years. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
We've got a photo gallery of images from this morning's eclipse on our website. That's at marketplace.org. There are rumors a new X-Men TV show is in the works, and given the gobs of money other superhero fare has raked in, it seems like a no-brainer that the project will get the green light. But there's a problem. The epic battles between comic book characters on the page or on the screen increasingly hinge on a multi-billion dollar fight between some of the biggest names in entertainment. Sally Herships reports.
Okay, we are going to get a little bit geeky. The story is complicated, so to understand, we are going to need a comic book history lesson. Back in the 90s, Marvel was struggling financially. The company was on the verge of bankruptcy, so it sold the movie rights to some of its characters. At the time, no one imagined a movie about comic book characters like Spider-Man or the X-Men could make big money.
And you didn't know what was going to happen with X-Men. Was Magneto going to look stupid?
Alan Kistler is a comic book historian.
How were you going to get someone who could really pull off Wolverine's hair? No one knew. And then they did it.
Fox made the X-Men, and it was a hit. It took in almost $200 million. So Marvel decided to buy back its characters and make its own movies. It got Iron Man back from Paramount. Sony gave up Ghost Rider. But Fox wouldn't sell the Fantastic Four or the X-Men. And that's when the arguing, fighting, and ultimately the lawsuits began. Marvel made a TV show, Mutant X. But Fox said on the screen it owns the X-Men, so it sued. The relationship went downhill from there. At the end of 2013, news broke that Fox was making another X-Men movie. A few months later, Marvel announced it was killing off Wolverine, one of the most popular of its X-Men. And comic book fans got suspicious.
Tell me a little bit about Wolverine. Like,
what do you need to know?
Is this?
I got it all.
By day, Patrick Helen works for a tech company in Boston. But by night, he's a Wolverine fan. Helen believes Marvel is willing to sacrifice its comics for the future of its films. That's why it killed Wolverine. It doesn't want to promote Fox's movies. It wants Fox to fail. That is the buzz around the comic book universe. And there are other rumors, too, that Marvel also told its writers to stop creating new X-Men characters and that it's going to cancel one of its classic comics, the Fantastic Four.
You have fans that have been collecting the Fantastic Four since they showed up in the 60s that don't understand why these people that they identify with are going to go away because of a business deal.
Fans like Helen, who even know there is a business deal, are one of the biggest reasons Fox doesn't want to sell its movie rights back to Marvel.
There's a built-in audience, a proven audience.
Jonathan Handel is an entertainment and tech lawyer in Los Angeles. He says when it comes to making movies, knowing you've got ticket buyers takes a lot of the risk out. Think about the movie series that have done well recently. The X-Men.
We're not what you think.
Harry Potter.
Spectre Patronum.
The Hunger Games.
I volunteer as tribute.
What all of those have in common is that before there was a movie, there was something else. A comic book, a book, a character.
And those characters, the Wolverines, the Fantastic Four, are the root of this problem. There's a lot of money at stake for Fox, for Marvel, and just in case you weren't confused already, another player.
Disney is now much more powerful than these other studios.
Sean Howe is author of Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. Disney bought Marvel in 2009, and Howe says the mouse can afford to play tough. He just finds the whole scenario surprising.
They stand to make a lot of money if they get the license back. The movies make a lot of money, don't they?
The movies do make a lot of money. It just seems implausible that Marvel would stomp on the graves of its beloved 50-year-old characters.
Do you have another explanation?
I don't.
And if Marvel or Fox do, no one knows because they're not talking. But the fans are, and they say the day may yet be saved. If you are worried about Wolverine or other characters, this is the world of comics, of parallel universes and crime-solving talking ducks. So anything is possible. Patrick Helen, the superfan, says Wolverine is only dead in the way comic book characters are dead.
Captain America died for a while, but then he got better. So it happens.
How do you get better when you're dead?
Oh, so Captain America was shot with a bullet that made him travel through time?
Just this once,
mentally,
let's let fans write the end of the story. Helen says if customers are willing to buy comic books or movie tickets, give them what they want.
And if a customer wants to see a sketchy dude with claws go up against a guy dressed in red, white, and blue and carrying a shield, figure it out, guys. Like, find a way to make it work.
From the X-Mansion, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Together, a collection of all our comic book coverage on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
In the headlines, everybody wants to say it's a city-owned pot shop, which I guess I leave that for lawyers. I guess technically, in some level, it is.
That from the marijuana mayor himself. Really. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average recovered 168 points, 0.9% to close at 18,127. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, 0.2% to finish at 50,026. And the S&P 500 added 18 points, 0.9%, ending at 2108. For the week, the Dow gained 2%, the NASDAQ added 3%, and the S&P climbed 2.7%. Technology and internet stocks powered the NASDAQ to another close above 5,000, within sight of the index's all-time high, set way back in the dot-com bubble. Amazon delivered a gain of 1.4%. Netflix streamed 0.7% higher. Hewlett-Packard printed a 1.3% increase, and Microsoft uploaded 1.4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.92%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, we'll get a look at this year's version of the baking soda volcano. President Obama hosts the White House Science Fair. The National Association of Realtors is scheduled to report sales of existing homes for February. And on March 23, 2001, after 15 years in orbit, Russia's Mir space station returned to Earth. It was brought down in a fiery blaze over the southern Pacific Ocean. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. Today is the first day of spring, and it's also match day. To new doctors across the country, that is more significant than the changing seasons. It's an annual rite of passage when they figure out what's next. Earlier today, some 41,000 MDs opened envelopes to find out where they're going to do their residencies, their next round of training. Would-be residents ranked hospitals and medical centers. Hospitals and medical centers rated would-be residents. Then a computer program matched them, or most of them. There are only about 30,000 spots. Atul Grover is a doctor. He's also the Association for American Medical College's chief public policy officer, and he joins us now. Hi, Dr. Grover.
Hi, Dave.
Do you remember your match day, what it was like?
I do remember my match day. It was scary. It was exciting. For us, it was 1998, so almost 20 years ago. And it was really all about the envelopes. And we went back to our groups of friends and family, sat down, and everybody kind of opened their envelope on the count of three. And I can just remember myself being personally elated at getting my first choice of a residency. It was sort of the culmination of all these years you put in, and in many ways a sort of final sign that, you know, you were in the right profession.
How complicated is the calculus? How hard is it to figure out who's going to go where?
Well, if you think about how many people are applying for residency positions, so you know that 8,000 people who have a medical degree, are not going to be able to go on and complete their training and take care of patients. The algorithm is one that really takes its roots in an algorithm that has won the Nobel Prize. It's a complicated process, but it works really well.
You're talking about thousands of students, thousands of people who have spent quite a bit of money to go to medical school who will not match. How do they begin to process that? And is this really the end for them? Is there a chance that they could go through this again and maybe the results will be better the next year?
This problem has really just gotten worse ever since I completed medical school. And the question is, what do you then do? You've got a student debt load of roughly $180,000 already. In about half the cases, at least last year, we found that we were able to either find other opportunities for those individuals, such as working in a research lab for a year. And then oftentimes, they're trying to make sure they shore up their resumes even further so that they can enter the match again the following year. And that's really because Congress has caused a big problem since 1997. For 18 years, they've put a cap on the support that teaching hospitals receive for training those physicians in residencies. As a result, we've tried to address the physician shortage by increasing the enrollment at U.S. medical schools. We've done that. The challenge is because Congress has refused to eliminate that freeze on support for residencies, we now see that increasingly more and more applicants are applying for essentially a very small rate of growth in residency positions.
What can we divine about the medical profession from the way that these matches are conducted?
We have record numbers of people applying for medical school spots in this country. It continues to go up. So, number one, I think the competitiveness of the match and the competitiveness of getting into medical school show that medicine is still a very attractive calling. Number two, I think the fact that you've got people who are willing to kind of go through this very rigorous process is probably a testament to the fact that people have a lot of faith in the process.
Dr. Atul Grover is Chief Public Policy Officer with the Association of American Medical Colleges. Dr. Grover, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
It's been about 2 years since Colorado and Washington became the first states to legalize recreational marijuana, and since then, Alaska and Oregon have done it as well. There is an economic incentive to legalizing the drug, but is it enough to save a small town? The economy in North Bonneville, Washington, was tied to the timber industry until it collapsed 2 decades ago. Since then, community leaders have been struggling to get the town back on its feet, and they've been wondering if marijuana could do that. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Conrad Wilson reports.
North Bonneville, Washington is surrounded by forests on one side. On the other is the Columbia River.
There is one gas station, there is one restaurant, there is a golf course, and there is the Bonneville Hot Springs Hotel.
John Spencer is the former city administrator. Now he's a consultant. And with a few exceptions, he's just described most of the town's economy. A few years ago, the town of about 1,000 people stopped watering parks and other public places to save money. And a few months ago, it started turning off streetlights to cut down on its electricity bill.
This city is on its knees financially. They have run negative numbers in the general fund multiple months in a row because they have no retail sector here. And this store could very well make a town that is otherwise going to fail.
The store Spencer's talking about, and in fact standing directly in front of, is the Cannabis Corner, the first recreational pot shop in the country run by a government. Technically, the city doesn't own it. Rather, it set up a public development authority to run it.
In the headlines, everybody wants to say it's a city-owned pot shop, which I guess I leave that for the lawyers. I guess technically, in some level, it is.
That's North Bonneville Mayor Don Stevens, who embraces the title of the Marijuana Mayor, right down to the personalized license plates he's ordered for his car that read MJ Mayor. He says there was a strong likelihood of a pot shop opening in the town anyway, so the city decided to open its own store to give it more control over how it's operated.
Whereas if a private person came in and opened a store and it wasn't working out in the community's best interest, we'd have a really long, ugly path to try and, you know, straighten that situation out.
Stevens says all the profits from North Bonneville's pot shop will go back into the community by partnering with the city on projects.
While it can't just deposit its profits directly into our general fund, can, as a separate corporation, help us defray costs with law enforcement contracts, public health and safety programs, any number of things that will ultimately have a positive effect on our bottom line.
Right now, the city's annual budget is $1.2 million. Officials think the Cannabis Corner could eventually bring in $500,000 in profits every year. That's big money here. After the timber industry collapsed in the 1990s, tourism became the county's main industry. Casey Rader is the executive director of the Skamania County Chamber of Commerce. She says the town's pot shop adds another reason for people to visit.
It's an amenity, just in my mind, just as another winery or a brewery. The cannabis store in North Bonneville just adds to that whole menu of options for folks to come and spend money.
Ann Rader says if people come here and see the region's natural beauty and lifestyle, they may just want to move here and bring their business with them. In North Bonneville, Washington, I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
This final note, at our editorial meeting on Monday, we talked about some reports the budget airline Ryanair, an airline so budget it once reportedly considered charging passengers to use the lavatory, wanted to expand outside of Europe, where it's based, to fly some transatlantic routes. Well, the company confirmed those expansion plans to several reporters. Apparently, that is not going to happen. Ryanair has walked it back. The airline issued this one-sentence statement. The board of Ryanair Holdings wishes to clarify that it has not considered or approved any transatlantic project and does not intend to do so. According to the airline's CEO, there was a miscommunication. We screwed up, he said. And that's Marketplace for March 20th. Today, the Dow rose 168 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, 0.2%. And the S&P 500 added 18 points, 0.9%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. Tommy Andres is acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. And on this, my last day at Marketplace, I want to give them my thanks. And I want to thank everyone here at Marketplace for being so kind and so helpful and so great to work with. I'm David Gura. Kai will be back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.